This one lay.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitah Wai. The U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, backed by Israel, submitted a draft resolution to the IAEA, citing Iran's incomplete cooperation in their eyes. And that seemed to have worked, and it was successful. The IAEA Board of Governors, with the vote that took place, has passed that resolution against Iran. Now, Iran has said it does not have anything to hide. Nevertheless, Western governments are accusing Iran of non-cooperation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look the ramifications of this resolution being passed against Iran, how that will influence the JCPOA revival talks, and whether this would derail the talks altogether. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, political commentator, who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, Daniel Lazar, who's an author and journalist, joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, first to you. So we've had the IAEA 35-nation Board of Governors passing the resolution, and just China and Russia actually vetoed it. Your reaction?
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, definitely this has been a hostile move, as somehow foreseen, and Tehran was in contact with the opposite sides in the nuclear deal, or nuclear talks, actually. And it has been sending messages in the last week, especially a message in the last 2 days, warning that, as usual, the path for diplomacy is open. Tehran is ready for continuing the talks as usual and within a specified timetable. But in case they go for adopting this resolution, then there will be a turbulent situation and tensions would escalate, definitely, and Tehran would reciprocate it. If you just remember, a couple of nights ago, I was on The Spotlight with you, I believe, and I said that Tehran is ready by every means to reciprocate any kind of hostile move by actions that will be twice more and twice tough. So, as you just witnessed today, Iran started its actions, reciprocal actions. Some believe that Iran would wait until the fate of this resolution would be clarified, and it would give it, an overall response to the IAEA chief Gerussi's mischiefs and the biased reporting to the Board of Governors that set the stage for the adoption of this resolution. Okay. And also the resolution and the Western governments. But as you just saw, Tehran is giving detailed answers. The first move, that was a reaction to the IAEA chief and IAEA itself, that had been, ignorant of Iran's increasing cooperation, was removing a number of cameras that were not, you know, that had been installed on voluntary basis under the JCPOA. And while Iran's not receiving the merits of the JCPOA, so it removed the cameras and some other devices that had been installed and kept in there as a gesture of goodwill. The second move came a few hours later after Iran declared to the agency that it would go for mounting two cascades of its most effective and the best machines, IR-6, the sixth generation of machines, centrifuge machines, in at Natanz in response to the non-cooperative approach of the IAEA and the opposite sides. Now that the resolution has been adopted, we should wait for Iran's tough responses, as I had vowed a couple of nights ago. In the next 24 hours, Tehran has power components, and I believe Tehran's responses are in the offing in various areas, and we will know about them more tomorrow on Thursday, I believe, or by Thursday this time.
Okay, very well. Daniel Lazar, as our guest Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh mentioned there, he talked about two reactions that Iran has partaken in. One of them, disconnecting two of the nuclear watchdogs monitoring cameras, of which it came out and it said that there's some ambiguity that is still being reported that some cameras were disconnected. There's two that were disconnected. That's confirmed. Now, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh talks about the centrifuges, the IR-6 centrifuges, to now have been installed. That's what he is saying. It's probably accurate, but I can't confirm that because this development came in the past, I could say, about 10 minutes or 15 minutes. But if indeed that is true, which it very well may be, but, you know, we can't still come out and say that. However, those are the two reactions, of which there's more based on what Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh said. And I can tell you he's very well informed. So given all that's happened, including the resolution, obviously, this past, where do you think these talks are going to be going? What's your assessment on it?
Well, my assessment is it's very hard to say. They could drag out for a long time, or it's also possible that we're nearing a breaking point. I mean, one thing that's changing is that since the Ukraine war, the Europeans are much more subservient to the U.S., much less independent than they were before. So, therefore, I think that Iran is finding that on the IAEA is on the whole much more hostile than it was previously. So Iran is up against the wall. It's pushing back. There are these small maneuvers are taking place. It's hard to say what the next step will be. But clearly the negotiations are not going well. They are not in a good place. But my attitude for the last few years has been one of great skepticism. I don't believe that the Biden administration is politically capable of entering into an agreement with Iran. I think the pressures on it from Israel, the pro-Israel lobby, the neocons, et cetera, are just too great for Joe Biden to buck. He will never give in. He will never drop the terrorism label, for example, from the Revolutionary Guards. That seems to be politically impossible here in the U.S. So I just can't see these negotiations as being ultimately fruitful. So yes, they may drag on for a long time. We may have these very intricate, very technical back and forths. But in the end, I think these talks are doomed.
Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, if we're looking at reactions, we already had two of them, one of them which is confirmed and one that which you have said. And again, no offense. I'm sure that's going to...
Let me correct it. I forgot to say that Reuters said that it has seen a part of the information that has been relayed to the IAEA that Iran has declared that it is going to install two cascades of centrifuge machines. I also have heard it from a different source, but, you know, I'm not an official But that's one of the many moves that I expected since, two nights ago that I said Iran would reciprocate. So I'm not sure if this has been declared by Iranians or not officially, but at least this is what Reuters has claimed. And I've heard it also from a different source. And it's widely expected, and you might be hearing about it if it's my words are accurate, then you will hear about it in half an hour.
So do you think that based on these two, one which we're going to get confirmation on, obviously, and the other which is confirmed about the cameras, you say that there's going to be other options that Iran is going to partake in, and it might be more severe? Again, this is why we're talking about this and why we have this program. What kind of options do you think Iran might partake in, given what has happened?
Well, Iran has power components, and the U.S. has long been going after the containment strategy through the through exercising the carrot and stick policy in order to contain these power components in various areas, including the nuclear industry, the missile industries, its regional power. It's nanotechnology, it's aerospace technology, it's laser technology, and many others. And I believe that Iranian responses would definitely come in the first three areas that I just mentioned, the nuclear and missile industries or its regional power. I believe it would be so open and so loud that everyone would hear about it, no doubt. These are not, for escalating the tensions. These are, let's remember that these are reciprocal moves. In other words, Iran is defending itself. Let me remind you that everything started last month. After 2 months of war of willpower between Iran and the United States, then Iran came up with a new initiative and called Mr. Mora to Tehran and informed him of the new initiative. When he was leaving Tehran, he was having a grim face, a happy face, actually. And then he informed his boss, Joseph Borrell, the foreign policy chief of the EU. And Borrell was immediately happy, and he said that there is new hope coming for working out a deal. But after a few hours, they both lost their hope, and they were sad again because they received the United States response, apparently very unexpected negative response, because the United States has started bullying. They imagined that they could ask more from Iran through exercising pressure. That's a worn-out tactic. We are very well acquainted with the U.S. negotiating strategies and tactics after two decades of bargaining and negotiations several times. So they started using leverages like media warfare, trying to provoke peaceful protests that are very, something normal in Iran as a democracy, into rioting. And then they tried, they used cyber attacks, and they used the Israeli terror machine for assassinations and sabotage attacks. They imposed new sanctions on IRGC and Iranian entities, and they also ordered Greece to seize Iranian crude cargo, which was reciprocated with the seizure of two ships, to send this clear message that enough is enough. You're doing this just as leverage, as part of the negotiations, to win more merits from Iran. Okay, we are going to reciprocate that with double more actions, tougher actions, in order to put an end to this kind of gaming that you have started. Let's do the negotiations, real negotiations, real deal. So ever since then, Iran has been sending this message that if you try, you continue this kind of option and go for the IAEA resolution, then we know how to play the games. We are not
We're trying to understand over here the logic that's being used by the U.S. and the other countries that propose this draft resolution, which is now passed, Daniel Lazar. For example, let's take a look at one of the reactions, which is Iran disconnecting those two cameras. Well, the U.S. comes out and says it's really unfortunate that Iran has done that, because that shows that, we are losing cooperation by Iran. Well, then why would you propose a resolution to be passed, which has been passed, when it has consequences like this? I mean, if the intended goal is cooperation, then why move towards lessening the cooperation?
And why walk out of the agreement in the first place?
There you go.
As Donald Trump did in 2018. Where does the U.S. get off accusing Iran?
And I'm sorry. I got to jump in here and tell you those cameras were operating as a goodwill gesture.
Yeah, yeah. But where does the U.S. get off accusing Iran of being uncooperative when it's the U.S. which has sabotaged the JCPOA? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's farcical. And these negotiations, which are dragging on for years, give no sign of making any progress at all, due entirely to spurious objections raised by the U.S., most especially concerning the status of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, which is not a topic that really has something to do with the JCPOA at all in the first place.
Indeed.
So the position of the U.S. is completely absurd. Yet allies are not objecting. The parties to the JCPOA are not objecting, except for France and China, Russia and China, of course. Instead, they are going along with this whole ridiculous procedure. I really know the parallels with Ukraine are striking. The U.S. pushed and pushed and completely ignored the possibility of a war actually breaking out. And guess what? A war then did break out. The U.S. is pursuing the same reckless course in the Persian Gulf. And I think it's very possible that one consequence will be the eruption of war in this theater as well. So the U.S. is essentially encouraging war in two, danger spots on the globe. This means world war, and the U.S. recklessness is just growing. This is absolutely astonishing.
But the fact that the resolution has been passed, there were question marks about whether this is going to go to the UN. What indications are there that it will or will not go at this point, given that the resolution has been passed? Do you think?
First of all, IAEA resolutions, the Board of Governors resolutions, do not necessarily end up in a UN Security Council voting. There are different outcomes. As has been stated by the U.S. and the EU, they've been saying that they do not mean to refer the case. That was not actually the content of this resolution. The aim was just, as I said, a political circus show to increase the pressure on Iran. Actually, if they meant to refer the case to the UN Security Council voting, it would definitely be faced with the Chinese and the Russians vetoing. And that's exactly why I say it's a political show, because if they really meant action, they had an easier way, much shorter way, without any trouble. They didn't need any kind of IAEA resolution or anything else. They could activate the trigger mechanism, the Europeans, and then they would easily go to the UN Security Council voting that would be veto-proof, actually. So they never meant to just do action, but they just meant to stage a political show to force Iran to retreat in the Vienna talks. And as I said, this is the last in a chain of moves, hostile moves, all to pressure Iran, which are all of these moves are pretty well known to Iran. And that's why Iran is responding differently from the past. Let's remember that Iran tried appeasement strategy under Rouhani for 8 years. Then when Iranians received no merits under the deal, the JCPOA, and they complied with all their undertakings, then Iranians, people, realize that this is a wrong way, totally wrong way. Because after 8 years of given wide access under the harshest regime of inspections ever imposed on any nation, they earned nothing. So they voted for the revolutionary government of President Raisi to change the strategy at home and abroad and go for reciprocal action for this, for the policy of staging policy muscle flexing and reciprocal actions, tit for tat actions. And that's exactly what the Iranian Supreme Leader said and stressed several times, that the hit and run era is gone. You may not pressure Iran and escape unharmed. And so they start, they are gaming. This is part of the negotiation they're doing. This is leveraging Iran. Right. And Iran knows the game. It's leveraging them. Now, let's see who has more options available that has not yet been used. Who has more instruments and options and initiatives and power up his sleeves?
All right. So we need to talk about Israel here, Daniel Lazar, because obviously it looks like Israel did have a major role to play with this resolution being passed. Even before that, when the snap visit was made by the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel, the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett told him, we need to send a message to Iran. There needs to be a resolution passed in order for there to be a message to Iran. Talking as if this resolution was going to get passed already, and I understand it was a short visit. And it's really strange how this resolution being passed is not the breaking news in a few websites that are Israeli origin. It's not even there yet. I'm sure it's going to come. So do you think that this was a nod by Israel when Grossi visited after it pushed for this to be passed, which obviously was presented by the U.S. on the E3?
It's very hard. It's very hard. The answer is I don't know. I don't know exactly what the process was. I don't know whether the pressure came from Israel or Israel somehow contacted its allies in Washington to exert pressure. I really cannot answer that question. But all I can say is that it is, again, astonishing that Israel, which has more than 200 nuclear warheads and is not even a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has the gall, the absolute cheek, the chutzpah, to criticize Iran's nuclear enrichment program. This is really astonishing.
Thank you for that. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Daniel Lazar, author and journalist from New York. Said Mostafa Khoshnesh, thank you so much. Political commentator from Tehran. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahvei, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-purification as agent of development. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-purification as agent of development. We know that there is no doubt that if one wants to follow definite principles in life, whether of a religious or a non-religious character, one must adopt a well-defined approach. In order to adopt a well-defined approach, it is essential to select a single goal and move in a single direction. Hence, one must avoid desultory involvements that may suit one's passing desires but are contrary to one's principles and goals in life. Self-control and self-discipline is essential in life for every man who wants to lead a human and rational existence. Therefore, when we look at the man, it is a being equipped with the power of intellect and possessing unlimited desires. We have unlimited desires that we follow, the wishes that we have, and therefore, on the other hand, when we have the power of intellect, we need to use these both in a way that we can reach to a development and the self-purification. Therefore, man's perfection and greatness does not depend on physical matter, which can affect his experience only on a sensible plan. But on the other hand, we have the innate, we have the fitrah, we have something which is related to the soul, and we need to think about that, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-purification as agent of development, and we said that the human beings, obviously, they have the material life, they have the physical and the aspect of the matter, and on the other hand, we have soul as well. When we look at the self-purification and we say that it is the agent of development, self-purification is not something related to the physical matter. It is related to spiritual matter. And when we look at the self-purification, then we see that a man's real perfection lies in his liberating himself from the straits of illusory lusts and physical pleasures, and in advancing on the path of humanity by edifying his sensibilities, disciplining himself, and becoming acquainted with higher ideas and a wider horizon. Therefore, we see that his goals and his perfection lies in the soul, in the spiritual journey, in something which is immaterial, which cannot be seen. And through the material and the physical factor, he cannot reach to the perfection. Yes, he can use these physical matters or the physical abilities that he has, this material world, as the tool of reaching to perfection. But obviously, he cannot rely on the physical matter only, as there are some people who deny the religion, who deny the God, who talk about the material world, and they want to, and they're trying to prove the existence of the world on the basis of material, as the philosophers in the West has done. But what they do about the immaterial factors, what they do about the things that are not fit, that are not physical, and we cannot see them. Therefore, we need to have this self-purification with the help of soul, with the help of purification, with the help of having some ethical rituals, so that we can have this purification, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country, and that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well, and we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner.
Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But, Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. The Great Recession began. Seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public health care has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe.
We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Nakba Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and disposition of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Nakba Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and disposition of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people's suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Again, the Western bloc, including the U.S. and the U.K. Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pakistan has joined the rest of the Muslim world to condemn the Indian ruling party. Two senior officials of the Bharatiya Janata Party recently made derogatory remarks that disrespect the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Indian envoy in Islamabad was summoned by the Foreign Office to record a strong protest. In a statement, Pakistan says the remarks have not only deeply hurt the sentiments of the people of Pakistan, but billions of Muslims around the world.
People in Pakistan are outraged by the insulting remarks. They are demanding strong action against those Indian officials, as well as calling on the Muslim world to put up a united front against this religious bigotry.
After uproar in the Muslim world, the Indian ruling party suspended its two officials, but people feel that is not enough.
This is a test for the OIC. The OIC has issued a statement, but it is not enough. This OIC must take a stand and raise this issue with Mr. Modi.
Aur iske par shokas dena padega Narendra Modi ko.
We condemn this. Such sentiments against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, hurts the religious sentiments of Muslims.
Pakistan's leading religious clerics have also condemned the insulting remarks.
All religious schools of thoughts in Pakistan have unanimously condemned what happened in India. We will work together and evolve a joint strategy against this incident.
The controversy has strained India's relationship with the Muslim world. Experts believe Indian ties could further deteriorate with the Muslim world if its leadership does not extend a public apology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Families of Palestinian prisoners and rights activists have held a sit-in protest inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of some 5,000 political prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as some 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for the military court hearings for more than 6 months. These detainees are held in Israeli jails without charge or trial for a long time. Their only recourse to call attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food for more than 3 months, and Raed Rayyan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since more than 2 months ago.
We are talking about the Palestinian administrative detainees who are boycotting the Israeli military court since the beginning of this year to demanding to stop the administrative detention. And nowadays, two Palestinian detainees are ongoing on their hunger strike.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers, where rights groups say they are denied their basic human rights.
Palestinian prisoners are being held under inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails. Israel refuses to respect the international conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners. We will continue our solidarity and our resistance until all our prisoners are free.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
Medical negligence, which is targeting hundreds of Palestinian sick prisoners, this procedure, we always talk about it, and we demand the international community to interfere and to stop such policies. And also the invasions, the daily invasions to the sections and prisons of Palestinian detainees.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Rights groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The moment of truth for the embattled British Prime Minister at the end of a day rife with speculation about his political survival.
Good evening. I can report as returning officer that 359 ballots were cast, no spoiled ballots, that the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes.
It's a result that means Boris Johnson is now a weakened leader and with an uncertain future, although he himself doesn't think so.
Well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country. Just in,
it's
just I do. Just in this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result. And what it means is that as a government, we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters.
But it's exactly this stuff that matters to people that forced members of his own Conservative Party to call for a no-confidence vote. Lockdown law-breaking parties held at government buildings at the height of the pandemic, when families were banned from visiting even dying relatives.
This vote was inevitable. We all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of getting the Jubilee out of the way. Why? Because the Conservative Party is really nervous about losing the next election. Let's not pretend this is about high principle. Boris Johnson was elected as an electoral asset. Now he's an electoral liability, and he's going to stay that way as far as I can see.
The sticky Partygate scandal played a major role in Conservative MPs challenging Johnson's position, but it was not the only reason.
It's about the end of party time in so many different areas. His green agenda is nothing to do with Conservative policy and is, in my view, directly responsible for the cost of living crisis. He's apparently failed to deliver on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is essential to a unionist party, a party that doesn't want to see the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then there are small gaffes, times when he just doesn't look like he's taking the job seriously.
Things came to a boiling point over the weekend when the Prime Minister was booed at an event celebrating the Queen's 70-year rule. And prior to Monday's vote, allegations of intimidation and arm-twisting by number 10 trying to get Conservative MPs to change their minds. And the last-ditch effort by Boris Johnson himself writing to MPs begging for a second chance.
So Boris Johnson managed to survive this vote on his premiership, but by a number that will continue to be an open wound for the members of his Conservative Party, which is why some experts say he won't be able to hold on to power for much longer. Saipur is up, London.
The U.S. and South Korea launched 8 surface-to-surface ballistic missiles off South Korea's east coast early Monday morning. These follow North Korea's test firing of 8 missiles a day earlier. During a Memorial Day ceremony, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol reiterated his firm policy against Pyongyang.
Our government will deal sternly with any provocations from North Korea. While deterring North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, we will pursue fundamental and practical security capabilities.
North Korea has conducted more than a dozen missile tests this year. Still, Pyongyang lags far behind Seoul in conventional arms and the overall arsenal at its disposal. The U.S. stations 28,500 troops equipped with various advanced weapons in South Korea. It's that imbalance that some analysts believe motivates North Korea to continue missile and nuclear arms development.
North Korea attaches great importance to the balance of military power, but in terms of non-nuclear weapons, it's impossible for North Korea to catch up with South Korea or the United States and Japan. So the cheapest way for North Korea to balance its military power against South Korea, the United States and Japan is through nuclear weapons and missiles.
North Korea's missile tests on Sunday followed U.S.-South Korea joint naval exercises off Okinawa, with the participation of a U.S. aircraft carrier and South Korean destroyers. South Korean intelligence and satellite imagery analysis now indicate North Korea may be ready for a nuclear test, its first since 2017. Even before his inauguration in May, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol had staked out a hardline position on North Korea, advocating for U.S. strategic nuclear assets, more missile defenses, and preemptive strike capabilities. The question is whether such policies will make South Korea and the region safer. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war are entering a new stage as Washington and its allies in Europe continue to send military equipment to Kiev. The U.S.'s new plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine has sparked a stark warning from Russia.
If they supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, we will draw the appropriate conclusions and use our weapons, of which we have enough, to strike targets we haven't yet hit.
Putin said Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He said Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Putin said the sole aim of the West supplying arms to Ukraine was to prolong the conflict for as long as possible. His warning was echoed by the Russian foreign minister. Sergei Lavrov warned the supply of advanced missile systems to Ukraine raises the risk of a third country getting dragged into the conflict.
The things that the Kyiv regime unapologetically demands from its Western patrons, firstly overstep all bounds of decency and diplomatic relations, and secondly are a direct provocation aimed at drawing the West into combat.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems as part of a $700 million weapons package.
The capabilities in this package include high mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, and guided munitions with a range of up to 70 kilometers, 5 counterartillery radars, 2 air surveillance radars, 1,000 additional javelins and 50 command launch units, 6,000 anti-armor weapons, 15,000 155-millimeter artillery rounds.
HIMARS is a mobile unit capable of simultaneously launching multiple precision-guided missiles up to 80 kilometers away. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Washington has approved 11 military assistance packages for Ukraine. The biggest was last month and worth $40 billion. European countries have also followed suit. Aside from that, the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians locate and strike Russian targets. But where does the line between supporting an ally and actively participating in the conflict lie? Many believe that gray zone is getting dangerously blurred. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider, bringing you back to reality. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sister Zainab Sadat.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brother. I'm really glad to participate in this discussion today.
God bless you. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you.
And on this side, we have brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure being with you.
Inshallah. It's good to have you. So we're talking about something which is potentially depressing, all right? Especially for those of us who are getting older, all right? And the question is this: what experiences and what things in life actually change the way that we view it? In other words, what do we learn as we get older? What do we understand about life in particular as we get older? I mean, there's some things that you can learn from books and from other places, from experiences that others have had. But I feel like there are some things that you can only learn from your own experience, and you need to have age to have experience. Sister, what's your opinion on this, your immediate thoughts on this?
Well, I believe entering the period of senescence is quite interesting and weird at the same time, because it's, for me at least, it is an indicative of somehow it's an alarm that your time to live is just coming to its end. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I guess the old people start to realize and observe the world in a different way. That is why the religion has emphasized our respecting for those old people, because I think that their view of the world is quite different from us as young people.
Called us young people.
You know, when I get old, when some person gets old, he or she comes to see the world in a different way that is respectable, that point of view is respectable, and somehow it could be considered as the right way of discerning life. And one difference between these people's view and ours, which is immature, is their life experience that comes to their views and comes to their minds. You know, life experience, for example, there are lots of things that for me as a young person or for lots of people are quite worthy, and they're worth a try, they're worth money, they're worth spending energy. But for an old person, all those things might seem quite worthless and unimportant. They just come to say that, oh my God, you're spending your money on buying that new car. Why are you doing that? A car's use is to take you to some places, and you can do it on the cheap cars
That's
as well.
Really, Yasser, the sister mentioned about how it's an Islamic concept to respect the elderly. I'd like to get your take on that first. And the second idea that the sister alluded to is the concept of things becoming worthless in their eyes after a certain age.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think age, when it comes to the outlook or a view of a person, depends on how that look is taken. For example, I'm sure in our lives we've seen certain people who are quite elderly, but yet they are the same as they were 50 years ago. What is in worth to them now is same as it was 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. They have not changed in any way. They have not looked forward. They've stayed in a particular bubble, and they've kept in that bubble. They have not moved. I know certain people, for example, that, you know, they may have had a near-death experience, but that hadn't changed them. Mm-hmm. You know, they continued on the same, you know, path. I give a good, there's a very nice Quranic example before we get to the second one. The glorious Quran speaks about Abu Lahab. Abu Lahab wasn't a young man. He was very old. Obviously, the Prophet's uncle. May have been in his 40s, 50s, and so on. When the Quran mentions Tabbat Yada Abi Lahab, will be one of those who will be in the fire, so it's a warning to him, it's an experience to him. He actually got worse.
SubhanAllah, right.
He got worse. With age, he became worse. So age itself is not a criteria. It is the view of that person, the way that that person looks at the world around him, young or old. For example, during the imposed war on the Islamic Republic, by the whole world, you had 12-year-olds speaking like 40-year-olds. Very different.
Yeah.
People like Hussein Fahmide, for example. The name suits him as well, Fahmide. So you have these things. It's not age, it's not merely, it's just age, like Ayatollah Jawari Amuli, Hafizahullah, says that age is just the amount of times the earth has gone around the sun. What does that do to a person? It has no meaning. It's just the amount of times, what does that mean for you? It means nothing, unless you take lessons from what you are actually experiencing.
It's a very good point.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
But we also have a hadith from the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, where he says, for example, respect those who are younger than you because they've committed less sins, and respect those who are older than you because they've done more a'mal.
Good.
And then we also have the hadith of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, alayhim as-salam, where they are performing their wudu, and they see that an older person has come and they're performing their wudu incorrectly. Rather than shame that person, they ask one another, am I doing my wudu correctly, to maintain the respect of that elderly person? And of course, he understood what they were doing, and it brought him closer to the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. So there is this element of respect that we